Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. I am welcoming you here to X Squared Radio. We're happy to have you here with us today. Last week was the Questers Conference up in Canada, Alberta, Canada, up in Calgary. I have to say I'm pretty amazed. I'm pretty impressed by the group of Questers, Earth Explorers, everyone. I was greeted with great hospitality. These people are astronomers, they're archaeologists, they're geologists, and they're all alive and awake. And if you get a chance to go to the next Questers Conference in your area, and they're all over the world, I highly recommend it. Much better than any rotary, sort of a rotary of the stars, you might say. These are the shakers and movers of the paranormal world, and we really appreciate their energy and their attention, and also their intention. They really are great, hospitable people. Showed me a lot of love, and a lot of curiosity about the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. And the solar wind is back down to a mild 355 kilometers per second. And the proton count is down to a near record-setting 0.4 protons per cubic centimeter. That means there are very few particles arriving to Earth from the sun, or anywhere else for that matter. Those of you that have been watching the sun, there is a 100,000-mile-long filament on the sun. It's not a sunspot, but these filaments now, observed very nicely by the SDO, the Solar Dynamics Observatory. In fact, they released an image today that's a composite of three extreme ultraviolet wavelengths, 211 angstroms, which is the false color red, 193 angstroms, which is green, and 171 angstroms, which is blue, each tracing a different gas temperature ranging from 1 million to more than 2 million degrees Kelvin. And I got to tell you, they highlight today's sun. It has an enormous magnetic filament, a coronal hole, and a new sunspot. That's just for starters. We are able to see things on the surface of the sun and just beneath the surface of the sun. These magnetic forces at work on the surface of the sun are really giving us something much better than SOHO ever gave us. And if you were out today in the sunshine, May 23rd, I don't know if it's just me or it may be you, too. If you have felt this, you might want to call in. The phone number tonight is 415-762-1161, anywhere, on planet or off planet, if you want to reach us here at X Squared Radio. It's 415-762-1161. The sun, after just a few moments, was rather painful to the skin. It wasn't like a suntan. It wasn't like just sunbathing. It was more like sun cooking. There was an extra frequency to the sun today, it seemed. And I think I'm not alone in feeling that. So if you've had that observation yourself with your solar detector known as your skin, why don't you give us a call and let us know if it's as intense on the eastern seaboard as it is elsewhere in the country. Also, looking over the next 10 days, now Heavens Above, as you know, is one of the premier satellite tracking websites on the web. That's Heavens-Above. It costs nothing to join. You can put in your coordinates, whatever city you're in, as long as you're in the free world. We tried putting in Heavens Above in Tibet, and I'm afraid to say that it's all blanked out. No satellite data over Tibet. Anyway, if you put in your local address, it will give you how many times and when exactly things like the International Space Station, the Space Shuttle, different satellites are going to pass overhead. The X-37B, which is the unit that was launched by the U.S. Air Force last month, is now being tracked. So you can see when it's going to come over your house. However, the X-37B is passing over the eastern seaboard over the next 10 days, sometimes twice in the late evening hours and early morning hours. But don't bother going out to see it. It is light wave stealthy. It is only about 1/100th as bright as the International Space Station. And perhaps that's for a reason. Maybe they don't want us seeing when it's going overhead. But I just thought you should know that it's passing overhead about twice a day over the eastern seaboard of the United States. And you can track it by going to heavensabove.com. Might be nice to keep track of. As it turns out, there's a lot to this probe. The X-37B, of course, was launched aboard the Atlas V rocket. It is a 30-foot craft, so classified that the Pentagon will not divulge its mission, nor how much it costs to build. So you, the taxpayer, have no idea what it cost. The mysterious X-37B launched successfully by the U.S. Air Force from Cape Canaveral looks like a mini space shuttle, but its mission is top secret. It is officially described as an orbital test vehicle. However, one of its potential uses appears to be to launch a surge of small satellites during periods of high international tension. This would enable America to have eyes and ears orbiting above any potential trouble spot around the world. The X-37B can stay in orbit for up to 270 days. It's about 9 months, whereas the shuttle can only last for about 16 days, mostly because the shuttle has human cargo as well. This will provide the U.S. with the ability to carry out experiments, quote unquote, for long periods, including the testing of new laser weapon systems. This would bring accusations that the launch of the X-37B and a second vehicle planned for later this year could lead to the militarization of space, although I would maintain that that has been going on for some decades, a la Ronald Reagan. U.S. defense officials, who would not say how much the project had cost, insisted, however, that it was just an updated version of the space shuttle activities. The launch was more about testing the craft, a new generation of silica tile, and a wealth of other advances that make the shuttle look like yesterday's space technology, which it is. NASA's X-37B program began in 1999. I did say NASA's X-37B program. And it ran until September of 2004, when it was transferred to the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency before being taken over by the U.S. Air Force. It was placed on the Air Force's Rapid Deployment Program, which made it eligible for unlimited amounts of funding and the prime launch vehicle for the Air Force's newest space-based weaponry. The flight of the X-37B is being managed, not by NASA, but by the U.S. Air Force's Space Command's 3rd Space Experimental Squadron. Quote, this bird has been through all of the shake, rattle, and roll, the vibration tests, the acoustic tests that any spacecraft would go through, said Gary Payton, Under Secretary of the Air Force for Space Programs. With all the focus on the launch of the secret X-37B, another space launch by a Minotaur 4 rocket from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California received less attention. It was carrying the prototype of a new weapon that can hit any target around the world in less than an hour. The Prompt Global Strike is designed as the conventional weapon of the future. It could hit Osama bin Laden's cave, an Iranian nuclear site, or a North Korean missile with a huge conventional warhead without the need for a terrestrial launch. President Obama promised a, quote, leap into the future for NASA yesterday in a speech designed to quell a growing dispute over his cuts to manned space exploration and to persuade critics that America will eventually put astronauts on Mars. But the transfer of NASA's unmanned replacement for the space shuttle to the U.S. Air Force converted a primarily peaceful vehicle into a primarily military vehicle. Despite canceling Constellation, the $108 billion program that aimed to get astronauts to the moon by 2020 and the Red Planet by 2030, he outlined a series of stepping stone destinations where NASA will first seek a foothold in deep space using humans and robots. The use of the military budget and leadership places in grave doubt. The peaceful use of space as a means to explore and expand the possibilities of the human race. A landing on Mars will come sometime after the mid-2030s, at least 5 years after the date Constellation aimed for. But NASA will spend more time before then looking at not just where we can go, but what we're going to do when we get there. Little does the public know right now that the military has been visiting Mars and the moon for decades with both men and equipment, designed not for terrestrial security, but instead is laying a foundation for interplanetary security of the interest of the United States government. The president delivered his speech at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. He said, nobody is more committed to manned spaceflight, to human exploration of space, than me. But we have got to do it in a smart way. We can't just keep doing the same old things we've been doing and thinking that somehow that's going to get us to where we want to go. The question is, does the government for whom Obama works want to go to the same place the human race wants to go? He continues, step by step, we will push the boundaries, starting with a manned mission to land on an asteroid sometime between 2025 before venturing further into the cosmos to scout potential sites to establish fuel deposits for future missions. The primary fuel for space travel, by the way, is H3, a compound few asteroids will have in the abundance of that contained in the soil of our own moon. By the mid-2030s, he says, I believe we can send humans to orbit Mars and return them safely to Earth. And he was echoing words chosen by President Kennedy in his 1961 challenge to NASA to put a man on the moon. A landing on Mars itself will follow, and I expect to be around to see it. Interesting. The decisions on how to get humans to such destinations will not be made for another 5 years. Instead, $3.1 billion will be spent researching new rocket technologies before a specific blueprint is selected for 2015. Orion, the spacecraft that was to have carried crews to the moon by the end of the decade, will be salvaged from the Constellation plan and sent to the International Space Station to be used in the event of an emergency, reducing America's reliance on Russia's Soyuz capsule. Meanwhile, the Defense Department will receive a $1.3 trillion budget and will have priority on any launch vehicles developed by JPL, Hughes, or the other major NASA contractors. Private explorations into space are prohibited. Critics of Mr. Obama's plan, who include Neil Armstrong, the first man on the moon, dislike it for its lack of detail and definite timeline and its failure to maintain human launch capabilities in the interim. Quote, "The president has replaced one visionless plan with another," said Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama. He said that the new plan, quote, "still ends human spaceflight," and added, "There is no rocket or capsule being built through this plan that can safely carry humans to space. The president commits to building a heavy lift vehicle 5 years from now, at which point he may very well no longer be in office. It extends the International Space Station's life by 5 years, yet the United States will have no way to reach it on our own." John McBride, a retired astronaut, told workers at a rally before the visit, he says, "We need sufficient funding to dedicate to space exploration. Back in Apollo days, our space budget for NASA was 3-4% of the federal budget. Today, it's a fraction of 1%. We have been told by our leaders that we can't have it all. I say, why not? If it costs a gazillion dollars to get to Mars, we get 2 gazillion back." When he spoke 41 years ago, the world listened, hanging on every word as he uttered one of the most inspiring phrases of the 20th century. Neil Armstrong earned himself a lifetime of respect with his one giant leap for mankind. But he has for decades refrained from exploiting it, turning down opportunities in politics and avoiding controversy. Now, the space gloves are off. The first man on the moon has teamed up with the last man, Gene Cernan, to confront President Obama over his devastating plans for NASA's $108 billion Constellation program. Mr. Obama wants to scrap the Constellation, which was meant to develop new spaceships to replace the shuttle, take astronauts back to the moon, and ultimately to Mars. I felt it appropriate that we would do something interesting here. I don't know if you have ever done this before. I know we've never done it on this program. When I was very young, we were huddled around the television set. We called it a TV set in those days. And we watched those amazing words being uttered as close to live as we could get it. I thought I would just play that for you right here, just so you could hear what it sounded like originally. Here we go. It's about a minute, 44 seconds. Here we go.
I'm going to step off the limb. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Columbia, this is Houston, AOS, over.
Houston, Columbia, on high gain, over.
Roger, the EVA is progressing beautifully. They're setting up the flag now. I guess you're about the only person around that doesn't have TV coverage of the scene.
That's all right, I don't mind a bit.
They've got the flag up now, and you can see the stars and stripes on the lunar.
Are you getting a TV picture now, Houston?
Neil, yes, we are getting a TV picture. You're in our field of view now.
I'd like to evaluate the various spaces that a person can traveling on the lunar surface. You do have to be. All right, you do have to be rather careful to keep track of where your center of mass is. Sometimes it takes about 2 or 3 spaces to make sure that you've got your feet underneath you. maybe four easy paces can bring you to a fairly smooth stop, like a football player. You just have to put out to the side, cut a little bit.
There you have it, live almost, 1969, July. Neil Armstrong was the first man to walk on the moon. There are 12 sets of footprints on the moon. Quite amazing footage to behold as we watch men going to another planet, 250,000 miles away, to explore space. We'll be back in 40 seconds. Don't go away. X Squared Radio is about to return, and you will join the program. There was an average amount of 24 earthquakes in the last 24 hours on Earth. Only one of them was over 5.0. The Earth is strangely quiet. You know, 8 days ago, there were only 10 earthquakes over 3.0 in a 24-hour period. The Earth has finally stopped ringing, but perhaps it is the calm before the storm. Also wanted to let you know at the beginning of this hour, lots of people have been asking, especially with the recent conferences that we've had, the new book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is available in ebook format right now. You can get it by going to rememberthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com, and you can download it and you read it, and all the photographs and drawings and everything are in color. They won't be in color in the printed version, prohibitively expensive. We want to be able to get that in print to you as inexpensively as possible. It'll be out in print in about 40 days, hopefully in time for the eSETI conference. If you haven't made plans to be in the Pacific Northwest at the eSETI conference, that's ECETI.org if you want to register. Bring a tent. Bring your binoculars, and definitely, definitely bring a camera, because if you ever even thought about seeing a UFO, here is the place to see one. Pick up a copy of the book. You get a 25% discount off of the printed version. Also, Twitter is alive and well on X Squared Radio. If you go to xsquaredradio.com, you can follow it, or type in X Squared Radio or X2 Radio and you'll find us. I add stuff pretty much every day if I have access to the internet. I now have it on my iPod, so I can, not iPhone, an iPod. I got too many phones already. And we add stuff from time to time, which kind of lets us know what's going on. By the way, the show was off start today by about 12 hundredths of a second. And that reason is because the atomic clock is slowing down. As it turns out, atomic isotopes are not decaying at the same rate that they were. We have noticed a slight difference. So if the program started 12 hundredths of a second late today, you now know why. I also want to let you know that we are proud members of the BBS Radio Network. And if you are interested in becoming a talk radio host, you think you have a story in you, you have the ability to speak unfettered for a period of time and have people listen, I encourage you to do so. I didn't start out this way. I am a recovering scientist and just ventured into the talk radio world about 5 years ago here on BBS Radio and still a member of it. All you have to do is get a hold of BBS Radio at bbsradio.com, let them know that you heard about it here, and I'll give you a bootstrap. I'll help you get started, and you can help me too, because for every one of you that we help get started, it helps us stay on the air. So we appreciate it. We are also venturing out into the broadcast waves We have started a 30-minute version of X Squared Radio, which can be heard at webtalkradio.net. This is a short, compacted version of X Squared Radio. It's designed to achieve syndication. We're going to do 36 programs and try to launch out there in the late night on broadcast radio to see if we can tell a more scientific story from a more scientific point of view. We don't do ghosts. We don't do conspiracy theories, or at least we try not to. I have been very tempted to do a story on or an interview on chemtrails, and we're still searching for a credible, really listenable witness that can bring you some factual evidence without scaring everyone indoors. And we'll bring that to you. So if you want to be part of today's program, and believe me, I could sure use your help after being gone for a week. We ran an archive of John Riley and Zero Point Research last week. There's a lot happening in the world. We're going to go a little bit more into the space exploration in this hour, and I also want to cover a couple of news stories. I know that after a demand from Representative Edward Markley of Massachusetts for a live feed of the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico to be made publicly available on the web, BP officials said they would release the feed and it will be shown on Markley's committee website. And if you want to watch that feed, you can go to globalwarming.house.gov, globalwarming.house.gov, and you can watch that feed. The release is expected this Tuesday night, so make sure to mark that down, globalwarming.house.gov, and you can watch the live goings-on at the now-defunct oil rig out in the 50 miles out in the Gulf. This may be BP's footage, but it's America's ocean, he says. Now anyone will be able to see the real-time effects the BP spill is having on our ocean, said Markley, who conducted a briefing Tuesday with independent scientists where he reiterated the call for a video feed. This footage will add analysis, or aid analysis, by independent scientists blocked by BP from coming to see the spill. I think it's interesting that our politicians are making politics out of a disaster, but nevertheless, I think his heart might be in the right place. Let's go to the phones. Scott from Florida, you're on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Brooks. I just wanted to take a step back for a second and talk about the e-book. I did purchase a copy of the e-book, but I was on Mozilla Firefox when I did so I couldn't download it, and then I lost the window to download the e-book when I did that, because I had to get out of Mozilla. In fact, I uninstalled Mozilla so that I could get back on Internet Explorer, and then once I did that, I lost the window to download the book, and I was wondering if there's a technical person who you could refer me to so I could download the e-book.
Sure. We'll put you in touch with our technical department. Why don't you go ahead and email info@x2-radio.com. We'll resend you the link, no problem. I forgot to tell people. I mean, it does say on the website, and I do forget time to time to announce here on the radio, you can't use Mozilla Firefox to download this PDF. I don't know why. It's a weakness of Mozilla, or maybe it's a weakness of my code. You have to use Internet Explorer, and not my choice. I didn't say only Microsoft will work, but only Microsoft will work on this. So if you download the Internet Explorer, you'll get it. It'll download in just a few seconds, and you'll have it for your enjoyment. So email me info@x2-radio.com, and I'll resend you the link, Scott. What's on your mind? What's going on down there in Florida?
Well, I think it's just the usual concern with the ongoing pollution and the Gulf of Mexico and all those things that that seem to alert me to you know, the A, dwindling resources, and B, the urgency for alternatives, just a general sense of restlessness, I would say, on my part, as well as exhaustion.
Sure. Well, I know a lot of people are down in Florida, and they've noticed that little tar balls are starting to come ashore. I guess the real devastating story is they've actually sprayed some of the spill with a coagulant that pulls the spill together and makes it heavier than water, which sinks it to the bottom. And what people don't realize is that the shellfish, the shrimp and the oyster population of that part of the Gulf of Mexico is now being threatened. From Louisiana all the way to the western coast of Florida, we're talking about the loss of fishing in that area for a decade, maybe two?
Yes. And I also assume red tide will become even more prevalent as a result. I'm not a scientist in that way. But I'm assuming because we were having problems with red tide about 3 years ago, and it was to the point where I could not breathe when walking along the beach over here in Daytona Beach when we had red tide over here. It was so strong that it was suffocating to me. And, you know, some people were affected by it. But, you know, I know over on the west coast of Florida they have it very frequently, and if the red algae, you know, if the circumstances are right, then they thrive. And I'm just wondering if, with all the oil and the damage that it does, that the red algae will take advantage of that and will thrive.
It's hard to say. We used to have red tides from time to time on the Pacific, where I grew up. And it is a red algae, and it puts off carbon dioxide. It robs the water of oxygen and makes it difficult for the fish. And it's usually a local phenomenon. It hugs the shoreline pretty well, lasts for maybe 2 or 3 days, and then it starves itself out. But red tides can be devastating to things like abalone, clams, shrimp, those kinds of things in the area. It doesn't really smell that good. We used to surf in it, so it's not really harmful to humans, but it does make for kind of a murky water. I don't really know how it does in the warm waters of the Gulf or off the coast of Florida, but in the chilly waters off of California, where even on a really, really warm day, the water might get up to 75 degrees, that's iceberg weather. For Florida people, the ocean's a lot warmer. But you can't surf in Florida either, not very well anyway. So I grew up surfing because I lived on the beach, or at least I tried to live on the beach 12 blocks away. But I spent more time down there than I did at home, so I'll probably pay for it in my second century of life. But for now, I'm still enjoying the benefits of it.
I also did a kyanite grid on myself today and last night, putting kyanites over all the chakras and doing a meditation while laying on the floor with that. And I felt that was somewhat rejuvenating to be able to do that. I have so many kyanites. I have about 10 of them, but I used them over the chakras. And that was a good experience for those out there who are into stones and crystals, that it's one way to kind of clear them, clearing the chakras as well as aligning them and balancing them to have the kyanites over the various chakra places of the body.
That's good to know.
I'm not a crystal rejuvenation.
What do you call it? A crystallologist? I'm not a student of crystals, although I have a couple of encyclopedias on them. And totally fascinating stuff. Just blows my mind that crystals, you know, we used to make radios out of them when we were kids, but they do resonate at least one frequency. They can resonate at many frequencies, and all it takes is just a tiny bit of energy. some of it just earth energy, to get them vibrating. And it is a known phenomenon that these resonations can have effects on biological systems. I've watched it happen. It's amazing.
And the benefit of kyanite and citrine both don't hold any kind of negative energy. So one can be in any kind of bad place, and then you get near those crystals, and then they won't absorb any of it. They'll in fact bring you to a more positive place. And I think before you'd mentioned that you had malachite and a rose quartz that you carried around with you, there was something about malachite I wanted to tell you. The malachite's an excellent stone for those who are interested in the mysteries of the world. It helps to reveal those mysteries, to help one study the mysteries and to gain knowledge by holding malachite, by meditating with malachite, and so on and so forth. So you're perfectly with the right stone, Dr. Brooks.
You might be able to help me out here. Somebody told me that malachite was a healer's stone.
And I would say it does that too. It's very intense energy. What, it comes from Bisbee, Arizona, where the copper mines are.
I know that it has some energy to it. I've actually seen, I guess what they call a wand made of it, and actually mounted with another stone on the back of it. I think it was a selenite. Really interesting combination.
And selenite has a strong, there were pictures, in the National Geographic a while back of these huge sheets of selenite that made people look like dwarves. Down in where it was Mexico or South America, somewhere where they're finding, they look humongous, the sheaths of selenite, of a dream stone. Has a dream energy, as well as I think it projects its own energy in terms of connecting people to the angelic realm, connecting people to their spirit guides. As well as, from what I've heard, from what Melody says, selenite is good for straightening the spine, that if one has curvature of the spine, one can straighten out with selenite. Gypsum is a form of selenite, and those are good for dreaming, for putting by your bed on both sides to help one remember their dreams.
Wow. I'll never retain all this. I'm writing as fast as I can write. I know that selenite grows rather quickly, and it's pretty lightweight. It has veins in it, much like a celery or a rhubarb, all growing in the same direction. It's a pretty rapid growing crystal.
Yes. Yes. From my experiences, it does. If you have, I've experimented with selenite logs. I've had logs as big as a wooden log that you'd put in the fireplace. I've had some as big as that.
Experimented
with those for sleeping, and experimented with gypsum. The gypsum seems to, I seem to remember the dreams real well with the gypsum. They're desert rose, gypsum, that's pretty much the same thing. They're kind of a brown looking stone, and the desert rose looks just like the name. It looks like a rose made of sand. And those are good for the dreaming and remembering the dreams.
To have one on that's the what I need to do is remember my dreams. I know I dream a lot, and I'm told that lots goes on there. Well, listen, I thoroughly appreciate the phone call, and keep us posted. And don't forget to email, and I'll send you that link.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Bye.
Good night. Earth Explorers, I wanted to let you know there's a lot more news, and I want to make a point of this because it's kind of current event. It may not be in the archives, but I have a feeling the effects from this are going to be around for a while. You know, state officials in Louisiana are saying they will not wait for approval to build sand barriers. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal said the state is not waiting for federal approval to build the sand barriers to protect the coastline of the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. Jindal's defiant comments Sunday came as oil pushed at least 12 miles into the heart of Louisiana's marshes. Two major Pelican rookeries are now awash in crude. Jindal made his remarks on a boat at the edge of one of the Pelican nesting grounds in a looks like Barataria Bay. He and officials from several coastal parishes say the berms would close the door on the oil spill pouring from deepwater gusher about 50 miles off the coast. You know, these gushers do happen from time to time naturally, but they're usually far out at sea, and these kinds of things dilute, you know. The solution is dilution, but when it's 50 miles off the coast, you don't have a lot of time. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is studying the environmental impacts from the emergency barrier proposal. Don't be surprised if they come out and say that the impact of the barrier is worse than the impact of the oil. The Corps didn't immediately respond to emails and telephone messages from reporters. There's a lot going on out there, too, and we'll keep you posted throughout the evening about what's going on with the spill, what's going on with reactions to the spill. And lots of people are asking the question, why are fuel prices going down with such a disaster in BP's own backyard? The yellow and green flower burst on their signage, and the continual flow of national commercials depicting BP as the champion of environmental causes. People are wondering why oil prices or why gasoline prices have not gone up. In fact, 2 weeks ago, a gallon of premium gasoline was $3.18. Today, it is $2.98, and we're at a loss. We don't know why. Normally, what would happen is the oil companies would dig in and start gouging and say that this is being very expensive to them, and so they're going to raise prices. My feeling is that maybe, a la Exxon Valdez, they don't want to draw the crosshairs to them. Maybe they, too, are feeling the economy as we are. We'll see. We'll see. We'll keep you posted on that. You know, I got to tell you, mankind has perhaps been here before. You know, the pride in technical achievements of NASA has never been higher than it was in 1969. A lot to be proud of there. We felt a sense of pride, a sense of accomplishment, a sense of miraculous accomplishment. Like we had accomplished the impossible by going to the moon. With the technology that we had in the late 60s and early 70s, it is nothing short of a miracle. Today's technology, I dare say we could do that quite easily. But before I get into that story much deeper, let's go ahead and talk to Mark from Ohio. You're on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Agnew. How are you today?
I am doing wonderful. Good to be back in the east. The northwest of Canada was absolutely stunning, looking to the west and seeing the snow on the mountains and seeing the dry, windy wheat fields of Calgary. Just an amazing planet up there. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and I wanted to tell you I certainly did feel the unusual intensity of the sun today. However, I have a few other topics that I thought you might be interested in discussing.
All right, let's go.
Have you ever heard of a researcher named Henry Kroll?
Yes, I have. It's been a while. Refresh my memory.
Well, Henry has written a whole series of books, but in one of these, he describes that he actually managed to get from a researcher in India an ancient Sanskrit writing that talked about how the ancient Vimanas were built. And I'm sure you've heard of the Vimanas, correct?
I have, and we were going to talk about that this hour. It's so apropos. Please carry on.
That's interesting. And I know you're probably familiar with the Mahabharata, which talks in great detail about how these flying crafts existed in ancient India. It also talks about the wars between these crafts. I'm sure you've heard of those stories, correct?
Right, right. These are primarily airships. They flew on wings, and some of them even had very un-aerodynamic designs, and nevertheless they flew, and we don't really know how. But we read voluminously about their uses.
Well, Henry got a hold of an actual schematic drawing of one of these crafts, and he goes into great detail about how they were built and how they flew. And have you ever seen the picture that appears sometimes in the doctor's office that shows two snakes spiraling up a pole?
Sure, right.
Well, Henry says that is the way the propulsion system on these crafts worked. What they did is they had a center pipe that went up vertically, or at some angle, possibly, and then there were two spiraling pipes around the center pipes, and they were welded together such that you could put mercury inside these pipes, and then the pipes were rotated at a very, very fast speed. And I think that mercury weighs about 112 pounds per gallon. So Henry talks about three forces that were involved in the rotation of these pipes. And he called them the centrifugal force, the centripetal force, and the Coriolis effect. And I had to do a little research myself to just make sure I clearly understood all those different forces that are involved. And I think the centripetal force is the force which makes a body follow a curved path towards the center. And I think the Coriolis effect is the deflection of a moving object when we have a rotating frame of reference. And sometimes you can see, like, kids playing on a merry-go-round, and then they'll have a film of the ball, and it looks like it curves when they roll the ball out. But
right.
Anyway... the point of this whole thing is that when these pipes rotate, because this very heavy mercury is going through these pipes, Henry claims that what these ancient crafts did was they created a time field, and they actually affected the space-time around the craft. And according to Henry, when you affect time like that, the space-time, it also creates that anti-gravity effect. You know, kind of like when electricity flows through a wire, you create, I guess, a magnetic field. Now you have this conductor flowing through a pipe, and that creates the time field. And when you affect time, you affect gravity. So that's how you get the anti-gravity. Isn't that fascinating?
Well, it is. And another benefit of being able to warp time like that is... outside the craft, it looks like it makes a left-hand turn at 10,000 miles an hour. But inside the craft, it's a matter of sitting down and having a cup of tea. It's really not the kind of turn that would slam you up against the driver's window. So that would be also an effect, that the space-time, that is to say, the field of affected gravity inside the craft would be different than the field outside the craft. It would be like a unified field in and of itself with its own forces.
So the craft is functioning in a different time frame, correct?
Than outside the craft. That's correct.
Yeah.
You could. It's a little difficult to explain, but if you've ever been in an aircraft... either as a pilot or co-pilot, and you've made a high G turn, you'll see the limits of the human body pretty quickly. I can take about 3.5 Gs, and I start going tunnel vision. I would not make a good fighter pilot. I'm way too big in the upper body. Most fighter pilots are about 125 pounds, have little skinny butts, and not much body mass, and they can take the G-forces. But if you could alter the time inside the craft where you're making what seems to you a nice, long, lazy turn, outside the craft, it looks like you just turned on a dime.
Yeah, that's, you know, that is just so interesting to me. I think Dr. Pete Peterson, who was interviewed by Project Camelot, also claims that he has seen those ancient diagrams, and that, and he claims he built some kind of craft for the government of some kind that operated on a similar principle. So I think that there's probably technology out there today that utilizes some of these principles. I wanted to bring up one more thing, and then I'll free up the phone line. I don't want to take up too much of your time. But another thing that Henry talks about is something called orbitally rearranged monatomic elements. Have you ever heard of those?
No, I haven't. Monatomic basically means that it's a pure, and it's not a compound. It's just a collection of atoms. It hasn't actually formed a single molecule. That would be a little bit like a solid mixture instead of an actual bonded compound. It's very difficult to achieve.
You know, you might be interested. I think David Hudson was the first person to really bring up what they now call orm atoms. And Henry claims that orm atoms are these orbitally rearranged monatomic elements. They have paired electrons that pass each other at twice the speed of light so that they actually exist in multiple space-times. And he says what you can do is you can heat up these orm elements. They exist in a white powder.
Mm-hmm.
You can heat them up with a torch, and you can actually watch the powder disappear when it is heated up. And he claims that the powder actually goes into another space-time, and then when it cools off, it comes back and is visible again, which I thought was just absolutely astonishing. But he says that somehow these orm elements, I don't know if I can explain this or not, but I'm sure you've heard of the concept of where two particles seem to be linked together even though they're at great distances from each other.
Yeah, it's called entangled particle theory, and actually there's a debate going on. We can't figure out whether there are two particles entangled with one another. We change the spin on one particle at a remote distance away, like in the aspect experiment. The other particle changes spin instantaneously, you know, immeasurably faster than the speed of light. We haven't decided whether they are two particles or actually the same particle existing in two places at once.
That is just absolutely fascinating. Henry says that something along the lines that these orm atoms, and even he says living cells have the same property, in that somehow they're attached through this other dimension, and in this other dimension, time and space don't really exist. And he talks about when NASA took some of their astronauts up, they would actually scrape a little of the cells off of the inside of their mouth, and they could monitor those cells, and they would get information from those cells faster than their electronics would send back. So they could tell the state of the astronauts based on those cells. So I guess the theory is that certain particles are actually somehow connected through this other dimension. Does that sound like what you heard? Or?
It does. You know, physics, biophysics, molecular biology, we're all kind of crossing into one another's territories right now. But I got to tell you, most PhDs are experts in very, very small areas, and they rarely cross over into other sciences. However, there are some generalists, like physicians and instructors, who are beginning to get enough cross-thought in various disciplines that they're now publishing books. A good example would be Dr. Bruce Lipton's The Biology of Belief. Excellent book. He was a med school instructor in the Caribbean, and made some pretty startling breakthroughs while he was working on the Human Genome Project. He experimented with removing the nucleus of cells to see if they could continue to function, respirate, protect themselves from toxins and so forth. Of course, they couldn't reproduce because they didn't have the genetic material with which to reproduce, but they could run. They could function. And it was discovered in that exercise that the nucleus was not the brain of the cell. It didn't tell the cell what to do. The cell had another way of storing its information and running its program, sort of like ROM, like a hard drive. And what they discovered from a biochemical standpoint, a molecular biological standpoint, is that it was actually the cell wall that was working like a liquid crystal, and it was storing information like the gates and channels of a printed circuit. And that's how it was running. That's how it was functioning. So the idea that the program could be, shall we say, overwritten by the environment rather than the genetic information in the nucleus of the cell was the real breakthrough.
Well, there's so much information out there. It's just absolutely astounding. I would recommend, I don't know what your schedule is like for people to interview, but Henry would be great if you could get him on the list. And I'm going to keep studying his book and try to get through it. I love when I find these kinds of books because it's just a total joy to try to wrap your mind around these concepts. And I appreciate being on your show, Dr. Agnew, and you have a good evening, and I'll talk to you later.
I appreciate you, Mark. Thanks. Have a great week up there in Ohio.
Bye-bye.
Good night. So, in fact, that is exactly what we were going to talk about tonight. Mankind in 1969 had once again reached into space for peaceful reasons. The only excursions into space known before this time were in stories about the Vimanas, as Mark was alluding to. And these are the world's oldest texts, the Vedic texts, that describe air and space traveling ships. As in modern times, the race to space, however, in those days, was also driven by the desire for more advanced weapons systems. Today, the only trace of these ancient flying machines of India are found in the Vedic texts themselves, and are thought to be only stories, although there are replicas out there. In the Cairo Museum, for instance, there is a model of an airplane. It was rediscovered by Dr. Khalil Messia, who studied models made by ancients. The discovery was considered so important by the Egyptian government that a special committee of leading scientists was established just to study the object. And I've got to tell you, we may post this picture on the website at xsquaredradio.com. Earth explorers, it only could be an airplane. It isn't a bird. It has a straight up and down tail. It has wings. Looks like a supercritical wing above a fuselage. And to elucidate the reasons for the decision of the committee, almost unprecedented in the field of archaeology, we'll consider some aspects of the model. The model has the exact proportions of a very advanced form of pusher glider that is still having some bugs ironed out. This type of glider will stay in the air almost by itself. Even a very small engine will keep it going at low speeds, as low as 45 miles an hour. That's the stall speed of a Cessna, which is very similar in this design. It can also carry an enormous payload. This ability is dependent on the curious shape of the wings and their proportions. The tipping of the wings downward, a reversahedral wing, as it's called, is the feature behind this capability. A similar type of curving wings are implemented on the Concorde airplane, giving the plane a maximum lift without detracting from its speed. I got to tell you, birds aren't made this way. This is not a bird's wing. It doesn't function that way. Birds have a different design of wing. Birds have a wing that obeys a principle called Bernoulli's principle. It's curved in the bottom, flat on the top, creating a very fast airflow across the top and very slow airflow along the bottom, which creates lower pressure on the top of the plane. So the plane is literally sucked up into the air, pushed up into the air by wind underneath it. The faster the plane goes, the more lift it has. Of course, you can use the tail to aim the plane and keep it from continuously climbing into the limits of the atmosphere. And the other, it's pretty well known, a Central American airplane. This is a gold plane. It's about the size of an earring, I suppose. But it has a delta wing, and it has a fuselage, not only elevators, but also a rudder, also not on birds. And it has a cockpit. Now, admittedly, it's small, and it's 1,000 years old, but it was either lost by a time traveler from our day, as it looks a lot like an F-4 Phantom, or they saw somebody or were able to fly in those times. My question to you is, what do you think? And I would very much like to have your opinion on this. And we will await your phone call at 415-762-1161. We'll be back after a short musical interlude. Take a break, take a drink. We'll see in about 4 minutes. Don't go away. X Squared Radio is about to return.
Make me a witness. Take me out of darkness, out of doubt. I won't weigh it down with good intention. Won't make fire. When we're done,
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. Sarah McLachlan, Witness. Great song. Just had to throw it in there real quick. Are we getting it? I don't know. Second hour of X Squared Radio. Please join us tonight. 415-762-1161. We were talking about Vimanas in our last hour, and one of the fascinating things about this discovery, and I'm just going to call it a rediscovery. As I was mentioning at the end of the last hour, mankind had once again in 1969 reached into space for peaceful reasons. The only excursions into space known before this time were in stories about the Vimanas, the world's oldest texts in the Vedic texts that describe these air and space traveling ships. And as in modern times, the race to space was driven by the desire for more advanced weapon systems. That's what fuels our race today. That's why NASA ran out of money with the X-37B and the Air Force took it over with its unlimited supply of money and the ability to hide those budgets from Congress and from the taxpayers. So, that's the mystery. What in the world is it doing up there? But one thing is for sure, with discussions of conventional weapons that can be dropped in less than 60 minutes anywhere on the planet, and laser weaponry, and even high-tech surveillance weaponry, and no humans aboard to change the mind of what's going on the aircraft. These are robots controlled by people on Earth, so twice removed. Helps us, it allows us to dehumanize the mechanism of war. $1.3 trillion defense budget and a mere $100 billion space budget over a period of time. That's the whole Constellation program. So what do you think? Do you think that the race of mankind has been able to fly before? Has he been able to mount wings to space, only to be caught up in his quest for global dominion and soon thereafter dashed to the ground by his lust for power? You know, looking at the Mayan craft, it's very interesting, the structures of this, and it's a tiny, but it is a metal replica. The structures just in front of the tail, strongly reminiscent of ailerons or elevons, like an elevator and ailerons that help turn the aircraft like a modern jet. With a slightly forward curve, they are attached to the fuselage rather than the wings. In any case, they look more like airplane parts than the claspers of a fish. It doesn't look like a fish at all. It doesn't look like a flying fish. If the two prominent spirals on the wings are supposed to be stylized version of the eyes of a ray, then the two globular objects positioned on the head of the craft, what are they supposed to represent? To complicate the identification even more, the spirals on the wings have their copies positioned on the nose of the object in the opposite direction. When the object is viewed in profile, the dissimilarity to anything from the animal kingdom is even more pronounced. It isn't a fish. It isn't a bird. If the zoomorphic explanation is supposed to hold, then why did the artist cut the head off almost three quarters from the body? And why is the nose practically rectangular with the cut tilted forward, with the eyes positioned at either side, when fish eyes are usually more near the center of the body line and far forward of the head? Well, the interesting thing about this, if we're just going to call it a craft, is that the Germans used this design exactly. One of them flew perfectly without any modifications. You know, when all the features are taken into account, the object does not look like the representation of any known animal at all, but it does look astonishingly like an airplane. The photos and the outlines of this are incredibly well proportioned. Several engineers, one of them was Arthur Young, a designer of the Bell helicopters and other aircraft. His analysis confirmed that the object contained many features which would fit the airplane hypothesis, but there were several ones that did not fit in that scenario. Wings do seem to be in the wrong place. They should be further forward so that their one-quarter chord coincides with the center of gravity. The nose is not like anything on airplanes as well, so while the object is suggesting an airplane, some features would not seem to support this hypothesis. But let's entertain several possibilities. If we imagine that the separation after the windshield is not a cockpit, and that the pilot and the cargo were located somewhere in the main fuselage, let's say, then we can envision the nose as something else. Let's assume that the nose is actually a jet. If the machine needs to slow down, the jet flow directed against the path of the flight would obviously act just like an air brake. But how to redirect the jet now in the opposite direction? If we envision the nose as a movable part of the plane, turning around the point located where the nose and fuselage meet, thus pivoting the nose downward to tuck it under the fuselage, that would enable the desired effect. You'd almost have a VTOL. You'd have vertical takeoff and landing. What's more, it will readjust the center of gravity, and the wings would be just the right place for high-powered flight. Another problem, though, will appear, and that is the drag, which would be created by the back of the nose now positioned in the front. But that can be attributed to artistic license. That seems to be the case because several other similar planes feature the back part of the nose tilted more forward, so the angle of the back of the nose when pivoted is more corresponding to aerodynamic principles. The interesting thing is that the darn thing's 1,000 years old, so it appears that someone in the Mayan age either was able to fly, knew someone who was able to fly, or had one heck of an imagination, or had a vision of what planes look like in the future. But to realize that this particular craft, this particular artifact, wasn't found in an engineer's laboratory. It was found in the general population of things, a lot like a child's toy would be. Now, if we found the model of a stealth fighter 1,000 years from now, you know, a regular old Revell comics, Revell models, a model plane, we would not say that that was an engineer's design. We would say that's a child's toy, so common that it would be in the possession of a child. Now, what we know about ancient Indian flying machines comes from, of course, the ancient Indian sources. India from India, written texts that have come down to us through the centuries. There's no doubt that most of these texts are authentic. Many are well known, ancient Indian epics themselves, and there are literally hundreds of them. Most of them have not even been translated into English yet from the old Sanskrit. The Indian emperor Ashoka started a secret society of the 9 unknown men, great Indian scientists who were supposed to catalog the many sciences. Ashoka kept their work secret because he was afraid that the advanced science cataloged by these men, culled from ancient Indian sources, would be used for the evil purpose of, you guessed it, war, which Ashoka was strongly against, having been converted to Buddhism after defeating a rival army in a bloody battle. The 9 unknown men wrote a total of 9 books, presumably one each. One of the books was The Secrets of Gravitation. This book, known to historians but not actually seen by them, dealt chiefly with gravity control. It is presumably still around somewhere, kept in a secret library in India, Tibet, or elsewhere, perhaps even in North America somewhere. one can certainly understand Ashoka's reasoning for wanting to keep such knowledge a secret, assuming it exists. If the Nazis, for instance, had weapons like this at their disposal during World War II, Ashoka was also aware devastating wars using such advanced vehicles and other futuristic weapons that had destroyed the ancient Indian Rama Empire several thousand years before. Only a few years ago, the Chinese discovered some Sanskrit documents in Lhasa, Tibet. That's the capital city of Tibet. It's at 11,500 feet. The oldest and used to be the tallest building in the world is the Patala. And they sent these documents to the University of Chandragarh to be translated. Dr. Ruth Reina of the university said recently that the documents contain directions for building interstellar spaceships. Their method of propulsion, she said, was anti-gravitational and was based upon a system analogous to that of Lagima, the unknown power of the ego existing in man's psychological makeup, a centrifugal force strong enough to counteract all gravitational pull, according to Hindu yogis. It is this Lagima which enables a person to levitate. Dr. Reina said that on board these machines, which were called astras by the text, the ancient Indians could have sent a detachment of men onto any planet, according to the document, which is thought to be thousands of years old. The manuscripts were also said to reveal the secret of Antima, the cap of invisibility, and Garima, how to become as heavy as a mountain of lead. Naturally, Indian scientists did not take the text very seriously, but then became more positive about the value of them when the Chinese announced that they were including certain parts of the data for study in their space program. This was one of the first instances of a government admitting to researching anti-gravity. And by the way, most of the claims that have been made in anti-gravity have come from China. You know, mankind stepped down off the horse, from what we recall, in the first time in the mid-1800s, and didn't learn to fly again until the early 1900s, after Orville and Wilbur Wright learned to make coordinated turns in heavier-than-air flight. By the way, within 6 years, we were engaged in the war to end all wars, or so we thought. My question to you this hour, and you can join us, and we're going to get deep into discussion here if we can, 415-762-1161. Anywhere on planet or off planet, 415-762-1161. My question to you, can man return to space without the desire for dominion over the Earth and even over space itself? Do you think that the leaders of the world today are still so possessive of their lands and gold that they must defend them against visitors from the stars? There's only one force in the world that can determine that, and that's you. I hesitate to even call you a force. You are a population of people like the world has likely never known. Maybe there were advanced civilizations in times past. Maybe they learned to live with the resources of the planet the way we have. Maybe there were billions of them. Humans, advanced, intelligent, loving, artistic, creative, aggressive, desirous, living on the earth. And maybe they too could not get along. Civilization against civilization, community against community, national pride against national pride, religion against religion, and maybe they wiped each other out. So here we are again, one would say. Here we are again, alive and intelligent and full of passion and full of dreams about the future. And we stand toes over the edge of the precipice, looking into the blackness of extinction. We, the people of Earth, we, Americans, Mexicans, Canadians, Chinese, Indians, Russians, Pakistanis, Jews and Arabs, all of us, breathing the same air, drinking the same water, having the same babies, loving the same women and men, and yet we have crosshairs on each other. We have prejudices and judgments against each other, and we seek to drive each other into extinction. Why? Why are we doing that? You're intelligent, you're gracious, and you're patient. You are able to love with a power and influence that is felt across the universe. And yet you are afraid. Why? Ramon from New York, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm so glad you're talking about this today, because a couple of days, actually, I got into a heated, what started off as a debate and ended up turning into an argument, and the person ended up calling me stupid. But actually, we were discussing the same thing that you are discussing today about ancient technology.
Which side of the argument were you on?
Well, I listen to the show and I go to East City. What do you think?
Okay,
I don't think I'll be listening to the show.
On the intelligent side, the open-minded side of the argument, that's what I would say.
Well, the funny thing is that I guess it's all what you believe, because the person I was arguing with considers himself a very open-minded person. But the argument started with the famous Dogon tribe, which, for those of you who are not familiar with the Dogon tribe, they're famous for knowing the elliptical, what was the name of the star? Sirius, is it? Sirius A,
yeah.
Sirius B?
Right, Sirius B, actually.
Yeah, and them knowing about the elliptical
orbit, but Sirius is actually a binary star with our sun. Now, the thing that really amazes me about the Dogon tribes is that they number Earth as planet number 6, not planet number 3, because they count from the outside in, which is kind of amazing, since we didn't really profess Pluto until the 20th century.
Well, that's how the argument started. I was referring to all the ancient civilizations that talk about this ancient knowledge, and he just said it was just lucky guesses, and no, that's not a lucky guess, and that's not a belief system. There's no way that you're just going to guess, okay, that star there has another star that you can't see that was not discovered till the 1940s or 50s, and you're going to sit there and tell me that that was a lucky guess, that it knew it's actual elliptical orbit, and they celebrate it, the Dogon tribe celebrates it every 50 years, and they mimic it going around. That's a lucky guess?
It doesn't sound like a lucky guess to me. By the way, Earth Explorers, Sirius B is a white dwarf, which is behind the Sirius star that you see. It doesn't put out much light, not much at all. In fact, you can't really see it unless you have a very, very good telescope. So to be able to attribute a lucky guess to an ancient tribe, by the way, the Dogon thinks that they are people of the stars. They may have very well been introduced to the stars, and maybe they did come from the stars and just forgot or just decided to get casual. I don't know. But one thing's for sure. They were dead accurate about the elliptical orbit of Sirius B.
Yet, with something that to me is proof positive. If you take that in a court of law, it's proven. You know, if they were trying to prove someone guilty, they would have been found guilty just on that alone. Well, how
right.
would you know?
Well, at least of being great astronomers. And so how did the argument progress from here? Once you made your case, they said, oh, yeah, what about this?
Well, what I said was there's only two things that I can attribute to. One was either being told by somebody off-world, or B, they were remote viewers, which we know a lot of the ancient mystics are remote viewers. It's not something new. And he said, oh, that's just hooey. And I said, well, if it's hooey, then why would the CIA create a program called Stargate and use it, and why would the KGB use it in the English intelligence and the Chinese intelligence to this day? If it's just hooey. Actually, you can go online and look up scientific papers on it. Oh, that's just a belief system. And it just...
Well, that's very true. I mean,
yeah,
remote viewing is definitely... at least a mathematical science. We've had several guests on this program that have talked about government programs of which they have been a part in training those that have a propensity for remote viewing. And when you get several remote viewers together, the accuracy and precision of what they can see, depending on the subject matter, is very high, like 80 or 90%, which is statistically,
I think he said something like 95%.
Well, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, you're speaking
I don't know
of,
why they're not winning all the lottery numbers, but as I said, it has a lot of it has to do with specific information too. It's not focused on one single science. Some people are very good at finding lost children, and some people are very good at finding hidden nuclear weapons. But the idea that you can have no secrets against or from a group of remote viewers who are well-trained.
Well, my point that I want to make is that if you're not willing to look in the mirror, as you were saying, as far as us progressing and becoming interstellar, if you're not willing to look in the mirror, and no matter how many mirrors I put around you, you just don't open your eyes to look, you're not going to progress. You're not going to see the true self of your... You're not going to see your true self. So,
I'm asking people to do is not... I mean, they're looking. All you have to do is turn on a laptop and hook to the internet, and you'll see. You know, go to a conference, and you'll really have your eyes opened. But once you see, I'm asking people to speak. I'm asking them to pull a handle, run for office, do something. Don't go through life as a spectator.
Yeah.
You know, you and I, we can't do this by ourselves, but we could do it with a couple of billion people behind us or with us in one unified voice. I mean, look how popular global warming got. The clarion call was... you know, right at the threshold of being earth-changing. And somehow the disinformation artists were able to craft something that convinced the general populace, oh, there's no such thing as global warming. It's all a big cycle. Man has no effect whatsoever on the climate. We don't have to watch what we're doing at all. And it's beginning to lose steam.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a shame. As far as creating new technologies and becoming interstellar, there's been, I haven't met any personally, but there's been many rumors of people who have created these technologies and just get hit upside, you know, either their family's threatened or they buy them out and say, hey, I'm going to give you so much money, keep quiet.
I have heard that too. And I, you know, to this day, I really don't know what to make of it. I can tell you that as an engineer of the new paradigm myself, one of many. I have not experienced any of that. I was, in fact, reading a portfolio of an investment banker just the other day, and he cited as the number one obstacle for new technologies, new businesses, startups to coming to fruition, just getting into business. And that obstacle was access to capital. That is the number one obstacle. There is no need whatsoever to send men in black or to do anything except just sit back and let the inventor starve. And that's pretty much what's being done out here.
Yeah. Well, how can the question next would be is, for those of us who are not inventors, how do we help?
That's a great question. I have the answer. I have the answer. I know the answer to this question. Here's how to do it. We know that the way the government works, or shall we say, not the government, but the people who are in charge. I don't really think we have a government. I think we have a loose coalition of bureaucracies. But let's just assume for a moment that there's somebody behind, for instance, the Air Force's use of the X-37B as a launch vehicle for this mysterious weapons technology that they have. Untold amounts of money were spent. We will never have a full accounting on it, I'm sure. How they do it is they are able to write checks based upon tiny bits amount of money taken from every single American, and maybe other countries as well. Well, that's the amount that's involuntarily taken from your paycheck each month, or each paycheck. What Americans need to do is they need to find a technology that they want to promote, like it could be electric cars, it could be water filtration technology, it could be solar power, wind power, any number of innovative technologies that are out there. And they could voluntarily take part of their paycheck and give it each month to those technologies. Can you imagine if 200 million Americans took a dollar a month, and focused it on one technology? Like, say, bringing affordable electric vehicles to the average person, or creating affordable solar technology for homes. $1 a month, $200 million a month. That's $2.4 billion a year that could go to this kind of technology. And the government would have no control over it at all, because it's all voluntary dollars that go into stuff. That's the kind of power that people have. That's the kind of focused energy that it takes to change a planet. And what's a dollar a month? That's less than parking fare a month.
It's less than Starbucks coffee.
Yeah, exactly. Less than McDonald's coffee, which I think is better than Starbucks, but that's neither here nor there.
There was one person I wanted to, I always get his name wrong. Stephen Greer, right?
Yeah, Stephen Greer, right. Dr. Stephen Greer.
Yes. I actually sent him a letter and told him I would, you know, take myself down to Virginia and, you know, clean the space for free and just to be around the stuff and help them in any way I can, and told him what I was capable of doing. And he was like, "Well, we don't need people at this moment." Not complaining, just saying that as far as on my point of view, I'm putting myself out there. So if anybody needs an extra set of hands, I'm not an engineer, but you know, even just turn this here, turn that there. I'll help.
I know exactly what you mean. I do the same thing. We'll work for food. Yes, I understand. And that is certainly contributory. No question about it. And I will keep you in mind, Ramon, because we have things going on here. And by the way, they're not classified. So anything that we're doing, if you want to find out more about it, you can always go to the website, check it out. If you have questions, you can email me. Ramon will attest that if you email me, I will write you back. I don't care how many emails I get. It will take some time, but I will write you back. They don't go into a round file. I care about each and every one of you, and I will answer you back.
All right, Dr. Agnes, I'll let another caller get on, and thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Ramon. Have a wonderful week.
You too.
So, Earth Explorers, I put the question to you again that we, as a people, as a race of human beings, we are all genetically very close to one another. Mentally, we are spread out. Socially, we are spread out. Certainly, religiously, we are spread out. But we can focus as a people. When you go out into space and you turn around and you look back at Earth, you realize that it's a very small, special, rare planet in a zone not too far from the sun, not too close to the sun, just right for life. This is the life zone, the Goldilocks zone around any star. No matter how big or small, there is a zone at which water will remain liquid. And the other planets, I'm afraid, the occupants are resigned to live inside the planet where conditions can be more closely controlled. I don't think it's too bizarre, not too bizarre. Keep in mind, people of the civilized world spend less than 15% of their time outdoors, some even less than that. In the more inhospitable areas, Houston or Alaska or areas like that, people spend much more time than that inside than outside. They live in some of the most beautiful, picturesque areas on the planet, and yet at 100 below zero or 100 above zero, it isn't very comfortable for human beings, so we have a tendency to stay inside. And for most planets that have perhaps 1/100th the density of our atmosphere on the surface of the planet, might be quite hospitable on the inside of the planet some distance, where it might be 80 below zero on the outside. It might be a nice, balmy 55 degrees Fahrenheit on the inside of the planet. Nevertheless, those peoples eventually have to learn to live as a planet. You know, it's cold, dark space between here and the next place, and as my good friend Kevin Smith would say, good planets are hard to come by. So we really don't have another frontier here. There was a time when the population of Earth was sparse, and when kings became tyrants and armies became oppressive, we simply sold everything and moved west to the wilderness. Well, the wilderness is gone now on planet Earth, unless you want to live at sea, or you want to live on the peak of a mountain, or in the middle of an inhospitable desert, or you want to live on one of the polar ice caps. There are still frontiers, but I dare say you're not going to get high-speed internet, and there's no Walmart locally. So, the frontiers being gone, the requirement, almost requirement, on this planet to live on a grid of some kind, either piped water or wired electricity. Most people in the civilized world live on some kind of grid. In fact, to get off the grid, to generate enough electricity to take care of all the needs of and wants of the average household, you're talking substantial expense. In fact, you're probably talking 5, 8, even 10 years worth of utilities paid in advance to get yourself off grid and still have the convenience of, you know, 6 or 7 kilowatts of power for your house clean water, air conditioning, lights at night, things like that, it will take you $25,000 or $30,000 to put that kind of energy source together. Is it doable? Of course it's doable. Is it doable by the average person? No. Not unless you're willing to mortgage a house with a second mortgage or a third mortgage or sell some of the stuff you have in order to buy solar cells or a wind generator or a hydroelectric generator if you're lucky enough to have a river or a creek next to your house. I do know people who have the ability and enough property to move water from high ground to low ground, spinning a magnetic turbine and making their own electricity. Now, it's a small amount of electricity. It's only enough for lighting. Other things like a washer and a dryer and those kinds of things have to be sacrificed. It's a small amount of electricity, and you still have to store it somehow and monitor it and go out and clean the mud out of the turbine every now and then. There's a lot of maintenance to it. It's not a simple procedure of paying a $200 or $300 or $400 light bill a month and having it come through wires under the ground through a meter into your house. But and some would say that there's technology out there that can make the jump, that can be affordable for most people to get off grid. But be that as it may, we are a people resigned to live within societies. We desire largely to live within societies, even if they're isolated among themselves, even if our way of life, quote unquote, is different than the rest of the world's. We choose a place to live. We choose an isolation. We choose an economic system that works like a commune. I use that word very definitely, not communism, but a commune where the people of that community all work toward a common goal. And there is no real pay, per se. You don't take home a paycheck, but you do get a home and you get clothes and food. And, of course, you have to work for the greater whole. Does it work on large scales? I don't think so. Haven't seen it work yet. Because you fall on that old 80-20 rule, you know? 20% of the people do 80% of the work? Right. And the other 80% of the people? Yeah, they're sitting down watching TV on your dime. It doesn't work very long. In fact, usually it's the leaders, it's the government officials, or the families of the government officials, or those who pay the government officials, or those who bribe the government officials, who are doing the sitting while you're doing the working. But small communes do have a tendency to function. They do all over the world, and they do in this country as well. Subcultures, as it were. So let's talk a little bit about it. John from Vancouver, you're on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Brooks.
How are things up there in the BC?
Well, we haven't really hit spring yet. It's weird weather. Global warming is not happening here.
Yeah, it almost didn't happen here in eastern Kentucky, for instance. We had 21 days of snow in a row. Nobody was talking about global warming down here.
Okay. I forget your original question. You were talking about the models that really look like airplanes.
Right. The Vimanas and also the Mayan model that was found of the little, what looks like very closely, a jet plane.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Let's say that knowledge to fly in those types of planes existed. Let's say that's true.
Okay, I'm with you.
What that would mean is that somewhere along the line, that knowledge was forgotten.
Right, which wouldn't take much if you had a big war or a cataclysm or a natural disaster of some kind. All the people that know how to do stuff would be gone. And then those behind wouldn't even know how to fly the darn thing, so it would go back to dust.
I got a slightly different take on this. And I was listening to your archives, William Buehler, the astral travel guy.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm associating forgetting with some of the stuff that he talked about. And what really caught my attention was he used the term energy membranes. You know, when you go from one energy level to the next, there's membranes in between one from the next.
Right, sort of like a semi-permeable membrane.
Yeah, and what he was saying was that traveling through the membrane, and unless you're, you know, you're really skilled, really trained, you tend to forget.
Well, that's also in Christian beliefs, and I believe William and I were talking about this. It's a little like birth. You know, we come to this world, and by the time the biological transducer is able to lens the consciousness, which usually takes, 8 to 10 years for the average person, you've forgotten everything. You've started over with whatever it is your parents and your local mores are training you with. But if you're lucky enough, well, I won't say lucky enough, if you have an opportunity to join up with your previous skill sets, your higher self, or do this astral traveling where you connect up with your original library, those experiences that you have accumulated, you can make a jump and realize that you're far more capable than what a single mortal life would afford you.
Well, I know it sounds really wonderful. What I'm getting at is because of this forgettingness, down through time, what it highly suggests, you know, according to this model, is that we've gone through energy membranes from lighter to denser, and that's why we've forgotten.
Well, that could be. So my question is, have some of the race gone on to higher, shall we call it, vibrational densities through another membrane, and they don't come back? So we are actually the primitives working our way up until we reach this level and go through the next membrane.
I'm so aware of being a primitive, and I find it really frustrating, but, you know, being frustrated doesn't really help. But I can tell you, it's really clear to me that I'm a primitive and living in ignorance, and it's not something I really want, but it's a fact.
Well, ignorance doesn't mean you're stupid. It just means you don't have the aptitude. You haven't learned yet. That's a different affliction. That's just a matter of getting access to the knowledge, and then you can retain it and do something with it. You're an intelligent being, albeit not, you know, exposed to the Library of Alexandria.
Well, thanks for that. And so the question, you know, recently for me is, if it's true that moving from one energy frequency to the next, there is a membrane, there is a barrier, and it does involve forgetting. So I guess the question is, you know, what techniques are available to move freely through different frequency levels and still be able to remember? And I guess that's what I'm getting at.
The key is to remember.
Yeah,
I mean, just remember the past. Also, you know, remember the possibilities of the future. I recommend, and I think William and I talked about this, I recommend using some form of meditation. It sort of quiets the world down and allows the mind or the consciousness to become aware of the more subtle energies of the environment and the universe and even other dimensions. Because our lives have a tendency to get a little bit too noisy, a little too cluttered to hear those subtle energies. So I recommend at least some meditation periodically.
I've been working on that myself. Also along those lines, you know, friends, family, whatever, get emotional about the relations they have with others and, you know, members of the family, or it could be people at work, that kind of thing. And especially in relation to my wife, I just say, you know, these are programs at work. Like, don't, the second you get sucked in is the second you're involved with karma, one way or another. And so there's no real point in buying into, you know, it could be a snub, it could be, you know, those kinds of things. But that's, those, to me, are like distractions, and that's what will keep you from, you know, calming yourself down and actually exploring more subtle levels.
That's, well, I think
as
that's
as
exactly
I've gotten
right.
myself.
Yeah. When we gain that kind of control, or at least we're aware that we have to have that kind of control, and we work on it. None of us are perfect. For the average person like you and me, it's, you know, it's a daily practice, and we get better and better at
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
For people who have their finger or their thumb, as it were, on the proverbial red button, where they can simply hit line one and dial up Wars R Us and take out their anger on someone else with much more force and considerable assets of attrition, we call that war. And what I would like to see is an end to it, where, you know, I don't care who the leader is. If they stand up and say, that's it, we're going to war, let's go wipe him out, have the people just say, I don't think so. Let's just not do that. Why don't you go over there and duke it out?
Yeah. Leading from behind is really not a good idea. It's not very inspirational. But I'll just round this off, and again, just by saying that I think the forgetting from previous technologies is because we've gone through energy membranes through our history. And it's probably, you know, kind of woven into our DNA almost. And so we've got that challenge now to remember. And it involves going through, you know, energy changes, energy membranes. So
that recollection's exactly correct. I definitely concur with that.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice to have, well, I mean, you're doing it, like to be part of a kind of a group that's aware of that and is working on that and you know, just evolving techniques or awareness steps to move through that so that we can at least have a certain number of people remembering together as a group. I think that'd be fantastic.
I think it's wonderful, especially when there's not a charismatic at the forefront of it saying, follow me.
I wouldn't be interested in that myself. Yeah,
but there's plenty of that out there. I mean, there are...
I know. Yeah.
Charismatics in alphabetical order.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why I came up with X Squared Radio, and I'm a little bit at odds with my producers and my trainers, my coaches, is they're trying to brand me. I mean, they're trying to brand Brooks Agnew as you know, talk radio host extraordinaire, but unlike others who are branded, and I guess I should say everybody, you know, from Sean Hannity, Limbaugh, you know, everybody begins in radio. It's their name. I mean, it's their popularity.
Yeah.
But X-Squared Radio is designed to be not that. It's designed to be the ideas well discussed and well vetted in an open and peaceful and positive way of the guest, of the scientist, of the explorer himself. I'm just a facilitator. And although, you know, people tune in to listen to X-Squared Radio, my feeling is they don't tune in to listen to me. They tune in to listen to the subjects that we discuss. It's the subjects themselves. that become the headline of the program. At least that's the way I hope it goes.
Let me add this. I discovered you because I was searching, and I can't remember how I found you. It's just I know it was through me searching. And so, as far as I'm concerned, it's partly you, because you've got experience, and you like to put it out there, and then you like to put it out there for discussion. And because it was me searching for something that I arrived listening to you, it's got this personal connection. I can say to myself, it's not, you know, bro, I don't know what your audience is, but as far as I'm concerned, it just came by just personal searching and that kind of thing, not out of a big, huge machine doing the promotion.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And so I really value listening to you, and you talk about ideas, but you put out a lot of ideas, so, you know, we have to spend time listening to it, and then you give the opportunity to respond. So the whole thing works out really nicely, and I feel a very personal connection to your show as a result of that.
I can't tell you how much that means to me. I really appreciate that a lot.
Okay. All right, I'm getting off now.
All right, that's great.
So thanks
you call
so much.
Back anytime. We love having you on the program.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, John. Well, Earth Explorers, that puts us about 6 minutes before the top of the hour, so I want to go ahead and take a quick musical break. We'll play a little David Acton, get a drink, get something to eat, come back. We got one more hour to go. X Squared Radio will return after this. Don't go away. We need you. We love you. See you in about 4 minutes. X Squared Radio. Thank you. welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Hour three, as we begin, as we began in the middle of last hour, I wanted to say that you are intelligent, you are gracious and patient, and you are able to love with a power and influence that's felt across the universe, and yet you are afraid. Why? Your voices, when joined together, are more powerful and immovable than any weapon ever designed. You can create anything you desire. And I would maintain that you have done just that. The messages left by the explorers and dreamers of past civilizations have gotten to us. We have only discussed a few of them in this program tonight. Now, can you set aside the hunger for your next paycheck for just an hour or so to discuss the future of the human race? Can you reach a little further than a single lifetime into the future, like our ancestors did, and try to bring something back to the present instead of leaving something written in the sand that will only be washed away with the most innocuous ripple of water? Bring it back to now so we can take a step in a different direction. In reviewing ancient technologies, we were talking about the Vimanas. I have to tell you, there seems to be no doubt that Vimanas were powered by some sort of anti-gravity. They took off vertically, and they were capable of hovering in the sky like a helicopter or a dirigible. One of the ancients in Indian Vedic texts, his name was Bharadvaji, the wise, refers to no less than 70 authorities and 10 experts of air travel in antiquity. And these sources are now lost. Like John was talking about Mr. Bueller's energy membranes that we pass through that may drop this forgetting upon us, filter out those memories. All we need to do is remember. The Vimanas were kept in a Vimana Girha, a kind of hangar, and they were sometimes said to be propelled by a yellowish-white liquid and sometimes by some sort of mercury compound, though writers seem confused in this matter. It is most likely that the later writers on Vimanas wrote as observers and from earlier texts and were understandably confused on the principle of their propulsion. The yellowish-white liquid sounds suspiciously like gasoline, and perhaps Vimanas had a number of different propulsion sources, including combustion engines and even pulse jet engines, which would have run on something like kerosene. It is interesting to note that the Nazis developed the first practical pulse jet engines for their V-8 rocket buzz bombs. These were the V-1 rockets, by the way. And Hitler and the Nazi staff were exceptionally interested in the ancient India and in Tibet and sent expeditions to both of these places yearly, starting in the 1930s. I'm sure they came across the stupas that were designed in the likeness of a Tesla coil. Of course, Tesla in the early 1900s developed his coils and was able to master great amounts of energy and even perhaps demonstrated bending space-time and causing invisibility in order to gather esoteric evidence that they did so. Perhaps it was from these people that the Nazis gained some of their scientific information. According to the Dronaparva, part of the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, one Vimana described was shaped like a sphere and borne along at great speed on a mighty wind generated by Mercury. It moved like a UFO, going up and down, backwards and forwards, as the pilot desired. In another Indian source, the Samar Vimanas were iron machines, well knit and smooth, with a charge of mercury that shot out of the back in the form of a roaring flame. By the way, that's how our fluorescent lighting works. We use a drop of mercury, we excite it into the plasma state using a shot of high voltage electricity, usually borne by a small capacitor. Once it goes into plasma, it takes very little energy to keep it in that state. We just bounce the electrons up to the next energy state, and when they come back down, they issue forth an ultraviolet photon. That ultraviolet photon strikes the powder, which is on the inside of the glass, affectionately called dope. And when the photon strikes that powder, the powder then emits light in the visible range. Ultraviolet, of course, you cannot see. But the dope on the inside of the light not only absorbs the ultraviolet light, making the fluorescent light perfectly safe for long-term exposure, but it puts out wavelength in the visible range. Now, some of the dopes have been very well engineered. Some of them put off a soft blue, some of them kind of a light pink, and there are even those that put off what's called daylight, which is takes a little bit more energy. You can't just put a daylight bulb in a regular fixture. You can for a while, but what will happen is the ballast won't keep it lit because it requires more power. Usually about 40 or 50 watts or 70 watts in a light fixture that's normally capable of putting out 25 to 40 watts, and so you burn up the ballast, but you will get nice bright white light for a while. That's how fluorescent lighting works, and for these ships to put out a blast out the back using mercury leads me to believe that they were probably plasma-driven. Curiously, Soviet scientists have discovered what they call age-old instruments used in navigating cosmic vehicles in caves in Turkestan and in the Gobi Desert. The devices are hemispherical objects of glass or porcelain ending in a cone with, you guessed it, a drop of mercury inside. It is evident that ancient Indians flew around in these vehicles all over Asia to Atlantis, presumably, and even apparently to South America. Writing found at the Mohenjo-Daro in Pakistan, presumably to be one of the seven Rishi cities of the Rama Empire, and still undeciphered, has also been found in one other place in the world, Easter Island. Writing on Easter Island, called Rongopongo writing, is also undeciphered and is uncannily similar to the Mohenjo-Daro script. Was Easter Island an airbase for the Rama Empire? It's hard to say, but it is located in a nice way station area out there. Rama Airways, flight number 7 for Bali, Easter Island, Nazca, and Atlantis is now ready for boarding. Yeah, I'll bet they probably didn't use it for the average person. It looks like, especially when you go into places like Abydos in Egypt, if you get a chance to go there, you definitely should. It's not an easy trip. You would leave by bus out of probably Luxor. And you would head toward Nag Hammadi. When you get to that military checkpoint, you would turn left and go out to Abydos. It's a pretty good bus ride, and you got to go with a caravan. It's not one where you rent a car or a motorcycle and head off on your own. But when you get there, look up in the ceiling. You'll notice the heavy beams that hold up the stone ceiling are quite ornate. And sure enough, carved into one of those beams, now this goes back to Seti I, which this building would have been fairly new in the days of Christ. In the ceiling is a rendition, a copy, of several aircraft, which are carved right into the ceiling. right into the beam. And many, many pictures are out there. Actually, there's probably only two or three on the internet out there. I took about 20 pictures of it, different lighting. You can't use a flash. And it is up in the ceiling where there isn't any light, so you really have to wait for optimum daylight conditions, which sometimes are not possible in that part of the country. It's kind of overcast and hazy sometimes. You can get a pretty good shot of it, and I have several, and it's a little bit clearer than the one that's on the internet that you go out there and look at Vimanas. That's what you're going to find. But some look like helicopters, some like jet planes, some like tanks, and some look a little bit like the Jetsons vehicle that they zoomed around in on the cartoon show. Unfortunately, Vimanas, like most scientific discoveries, were ultimately used for war. Atlanteans used their flying machines, Vailixi, a similar type of aircraft, to literally try and subjugate the world, it would seem, if Indian texts are to be believed. The Atlanteans, known as Asvins in the Indian writings, were apparently even more advanced technologically than the Indians, and certainly of a more warlike temperament. Although no ancient texts on Atlantean Vailixi are known to exist, some information has come down through esoteric, quote, occult sources, which describe their flying machines, similar, if not identical, to Vimanas. Now, Vailixi were generally cigar-shaped and had the capability of maneuvering underwater as well as in the atmosphere or even in outer space. Other vehicles, like Vimanas, were saucer-shaped and could apparently also be submerged. By the way, USOs, undersea objects, unidentified, of course, are quite plentiful. They come up out of the water and zoom up into the sky and go plasma and disappear. And some have been recorded by military observers and tracked on radar, coming out of the water, achieving Mach 8, and going straight out into space. I'm sure quite alarming to Navy seamen who might be on the boat plodding along at 10 or 12 or 15 knots to see something come out of the water like that would be very, very shocking. The point is that we have an ancient society, an ancient civilization, at least one, maybe two, that had advanced flying machines, and it appears that they did not use them for public transportation the way we do. We at least have that much peaceably on them. Most airplanes in the world today are used for public transportation. You buy a ticket, you sit in a nice, comfortable seat, you put some music on your head, you have a controlled atmosphere on the inside. If you're very lucky, you'll get a bag of peanuts, and you arrive at your destination with barely a wrinkle in your clothes. Unless, of course, you're flying to overseas, to Europe or to China. If you fly to China, you can watch all the movies and eat all the food, and you still have 5-6 hours to go. So it's a long, long flight, and you will definitely have wrinkles in your clothes and probably some of your body parts, too, by the time you get there. But nevertheless, these are not warplanes, and the vast majority, hundreds of thousands of flights every single month, take place for peaceful purposes on this planet, and that's the way it should be. Now, in ancient times, it appears that these craft were basically and primarily used for warfare. They were used for high-speed assault, high-speed defense, and maybe for military exploration and surveillance, but not for general public transportation. Now, it would seem that there was a pattern to go by. It would seem that our government and the governments, the military governments of the world, have craft that they fly that the public never gets to ride in. We'll never see it. We might look up and say, wow, what was that flying at Mach 10 across the sky? and it's ours. It has our markings on it, or it has UN markings on it, or something like that. These are even more advanced aircraft. I can tell you this much. As a former member of the United States Air Force, albeit not much, just a simple E-4, I can tell you that the military, the general rank and file military, does not have as advanced technology as the private sector. We are some years behind in that. But the advanced areas of the military do have the latest stuff. Why? Because it's their money that developed it. So the radios and the tools and the diagnostic equipment that we have as far as electronics is a little aged. If you come out of the Air Force, you're going to have some training to be sure. But it's going to be 3 to 5, maybe even more years behind the private sector. The private sector moves at a much, much faster pace. Unless it comes to weaponry. Then you're talking about very, very advanced systems. Surveillance systems and flying systems and ability to surveil from outer space. And now it appears kill from outer space. So we want to progress as a race. We want to grow beyond that. So I'm asking you to help me dream a little bit tonight. You can call in at 415-762-1161. Call in and share a vision of what you have seen for the future. Believe me, it's important. If you have been out there in the future and seen a possibility of a future, I'd like to hear about it tonight. 415-762-1161. Now, I don't want you to call in and say, yes, I saw Armageddon, we wipe each other out, there's a nuclear winter, and let's try to keep it a little positive. Let's talk about social visions or even technological visions that have some kind of positive twist to it, because I have a reason for doing this. I believe that if we share this dream, it adds a little bit of energy to it and it raises its possibility, as Amit Goswami would say, of becoming a reality. So what have you dreamed out there? What have you seen in your meditations that has shown you we can rise above the warrior inside us and become the explorer? So speaking of exploring, we have talked from time to time about the Themis probes. Themis was a set of probes, 5 of them, put in a single capsule, launched out into space in 2007. And it was interesting what they were sent up to do. They discovered that the northern lights are seen when electrical tornadoes rotating faster than 1 million miles an hour hover about 40,000 miles above the Earth. The energy spins down to the Earth's ionosphere, where the tornadoes become unstable and interact with the Earth's magnetic field. Despite a lack of empirical evidence, like interaction with satellites, the public reports go unchallenged in mainstream science. Professor Karl Heinz Glassmeyer, director of the Institute for Geophysics and Extraterrestrial Physics in Braunschweig, Germany, explains, "When these space tornadoes reach the upper atmosphere, their enormous energy heats the air so strongly it starts glowing. That is what generates the aurorae. It is here that all the energy is released, forming the aurorae. What we see as beautiful lights and colors are actually the product of a violent electrical storm in space. While these electrical discharges do not cause any direct harm to humans, they can damage man-made structures, such as power transformers and communication systems," said Andreas Keiling, a physicist at the University of California at Berkeley. Time, history of events, and macro-scale interactions during substorms are 5 probes, the Themis probes, launched by NASA in February of 2007. They orbit the Earth, recording the volume and electrical current, which was higher than 100,000 amps. 100,000 amps, that's a lot of current. Those of you that remember the dynamo experiment, where the shuttle was sent up and a tether was stretched out several tens of miles in order to try to measure the moving space shuttle, moving that tether through the magnetic field to see what kind of current could be realized. And the tether, although made of Kevlar, exploded. There was far more energy surrounding the space shuttle than what was expected. I questioned the space tornadoes, though. You know, the Themis probes only orbit about 200 to 400 miles out into space. That's it. The fact that the five line up every now and then where they're able to take a reading sort of like a string of pearls out into space. The first paper that came out said that there was a cosmic bullet between satellites 3 and 4. It passed 4 and 5 heading out for space, 3, 2, and 1 heading for Earth, and lo and behold, there was an aurora. They have no idea where the bullet came from. Not in reality. They said it was magnetic ropes left behind by the sun. Even though it's 93 million miles away, yes, we're in its gravitational pull, but the magnetism from the sun doesn't stretch out that far. Now they're talking about electrical tornadoes 40,000 miles out into space, far beyond the scope of the Themis probes, to be sure. Now, scientists had previously concluded that the aurorae were caused by electrically charged particles discharged as solar winds from the sun, which interact with the Earth's magnetic field. However, these solar discharges strike the Earth where the sun is shining, and the aurora occur in the opposite hemisphere and are visible in the night sky. Those of you that don't know what they're talking about here, the Earth is tilted on a 23-degree angle on its axis. So the sunward side of the Earth during the season when we see the auroras is the side of the Earth facing away from the sun. And so that, coupled with the picture that they revealed that there were auroras over both poles at the same time, it still has not been addressed by publications relating to the Themis probes. In other words, the official reports do not explain the dual auroras that have been observed. Additionally, the space tornado theory has not affected any orbiting satellite. No transmission has been upset by these electrical tornadoes. In short, I think it's a fancy news release. I don't really think we have a reading on electrical space tornadoes. The evidence shows that the auroras are at least an interaction between forces that are inside the Earth and not necessarily forces that are outside the Earth. This is profound. Very profound, because what it implies directly by the empirical evidence is that there is a charged body on the inside of the Earth rotating at least a different RPM than the crust of the Earth, thus causing this very strong magnetic field, which we know as our magnetosphere. But when we see these counter-rotating bodies in space, and the very largest of them are called quasars, we see highly accelerated jets of particles at the poles, straight out the north and south of that pole, a lot like the pranic tube that goes parallel to, or at least congruent with, the human spine. Coming out the base of the spine and the top of the spine, that would be the root and the crown chakras, we also theorize and have measured energy coming out of the human body, much like it comes out of the quasar, especially in times when a Merkaba field can be rotated by the intention and concentration of that person. Now, if that is the case, then we are not talking about a molten ball of lava floating through space upon which we live, on a cornflake floating around in a bowl of milk. so to speak. That means that we have a solid core and we have a solid crust. They're both complete with gravitational mass, and they're counter-rotating against each other. And this is what causes the ion flow out the north and south poles of the Earth. Now, that interaction with the right conditions of the atmosphere is what causes the aurora. And it's not going to be corroborated by a space-based probe, except to prove that the effect is not caused from space alone. It is also caused by this force on the inside of the Earth, which would support something like hollow Earth theory. Very interesting. One more case. Why we need to go to the North Pole and take some measurements. Come on, let's go, let's do it. So, in the spirit of exploration, some things have happened in the last few weeks, of which we have been involved. And I'd say it was about 3 weeks ago, someone released, I think it was Brown, released a nighttime video taken of some digging going on near the Sphinx. Now, people, when you're shooting nighttime videos, please remember to turn your video camera to infrared. Almost every Sony camera, most of the Canon cameras, and most of the Kodak cameras have a night vision function. Now, it's not going to take a photograph or a film that you would recognize invisible light, more than likely. You're going to get heat signatures from it in the infrared band, not the visible band. But at nighttime, this is the kind of filming that you have to do if you're going to get some kind of detail. Now, this video was shot of excavation and digging that was going on in and around in front of the Sphinx. Now, this is independent of the Red Bull event that just took place. Those of you that were able to watch it on television, you can watch it on the internet if you want. A BMX Red Bull event. Who could imagine building bicycle ramps in front of Giza? But that's what they did. Next to it was another dig, where they had excavated down about 40 feet, maybe four stories, something like that, had gotten to a certain level and dug a shaft, which by my estimation is about 24 feet by 24 feet, shored up with wood and with sandbags. Now, what was claimed in this video is that items were being removed from under the ground, and we really couldn't see what they were. Now, there were some drawings around it, but, you know, it's kind of like the movie of a UFO at night. It's a little fuzzy. It's a little bit out of focus. It's not really well done, not like Hollywood would do it. And so all it really did is stir people up and make people start talking, until one of my colleagues, who happened to be in Egypt, got access to the area during the daytime. Yes, during the daytime. And shot 20 photographs, very clear, almost clear enough where you could see the people's faces that were working on it. And we published those pictures, keeping the identity of the person secret at that person's request. So those pictures hit Facebook and went from profile to profile around the world. They've been viewed tens of thousands of times in the last 2 weeks, and now the truth is out. There's a dig going on in front of the Sphinx. And based on one of the photographs there, it looks like something or things have been crated up in wooden crates. We don't know if they're being hauled to a museum or not, but one has the suspicion that although this is a sanctioned dig, that is to say, somebody high up is in on the know, because it's happening right in front of the Sphinx, and they have another event which had a small amount of excavation and some scaffolding set up and some equipment set up going on right next to it, and it appears to be kind of a cover for it. So the conspiracies are flying, let me tell you. But a picture is worth 10,000 words, especially a daytime picture. And believe me, the eyes of the world are upon this area, and rightfully so. Because the fact that the world's most important archaeological site was being excavated in the first place without the world press involved is absolutely unthinkable. The suspicion that something was being removed that might date back to the 25th dynasty or before was hair-raising and shocking to the archaeological community. Now, claims that the water table was threatening the structure's integrity and the site had to be relieved of the water and some shafts had to be dug to kind of shore up the area. I'm not a geologist. I am somewhat of an architect. I would say, no pun intended, doesn't hold water for me. I'm not buying it. Not digging a shaft like that, not having those kinds of individuals, they look like Western Europeans or even Americans standing around the dig, and I would venture to say that if I had the high resolution of the photograph up, you would be able to recognize who these people were. But as you know, we use flash and we use low resolution, so you can't get that kind of detail. But you can clearly see that something is going on. And I have personally have pictures of larger earth-moving equipment coming out of the desert to the west of Cairo in the area speculated to be Memphis or the outskirt of ancient Heliopolis. And my question is, what were they doing out there? Were they building roads across the largest ancient city in the world? Sure, why not? I doubt it. Seriously. But I can tell you, as nations inherit land and inherit the artifacts that are upon that land, they claim ownership. The indigenous peoples of North America have enjoyed no less. Even now, in Alberta, Canada, there is an ancient solar observatory that spans a diameter of more than a mile. It has been documented, photographed, it's been measured and confirmed by numerous years of sun tracking, yet the government of Canada refuses to acknowledge its existence. Why? This site is more than 5,000 years old. Why? Because the government of Canada also controls all the oil exploration in Alberta. And the listing of an ancient site of this quality would inhibit the free and unfettered drilling for oil in these areas. So it will not be listed or studied officially. It's a remote location west of, and I didn't make this up, west of Brooks, Alberta. Scientist Gordon Freeman, he's a commercial chemist. I met him myself. I watched his demonstration. I saw his photographs, I listened to his very meticulous study, and he discovered a sun temple that predates Stonehenge. According to Freeman, it was constructed some 5,000 years ago by the Oxbow people and contains a solar calendar like ours, but slightly more accurate. He states that the site also contains a detailed lunar calendar. He also states that every single calendar that we use on the earth today was formed by a religion, and they're all wrong. During field work in England from 1986 to the year 2006, Freeman found striking similarities between the surface geometries of Stonehenge and this site. Findings which have far-reaching historical implications. These discoveries are carefully documented and interpreted in Gordon Freeman's new book, and this book is called Canada's Stonehenge. It's a hardbound book. The photography is stunning. The study is very meticulous. Canada's Stonehenge. It's subtitled Astounding Archaeological Discoveries in Canada, England, and Wales. So it actually spans a period of 5,000 years, and as you know, the sun, the equinoxes, march across the zodiac, and over a period of 5,000 years, that equinox, even though it shifted, it was marked every 500 years by this observatory. This calendar actually had stones put in place to mark the new equinoxes every 500 years. That's how long it's been there. That's how long it's been used. You can see it from the air very clearly. From the ground, it's so large in diameter, it's difficult to see. But he carefully went out there in the dead of winter and in the summer, setting up his cameras, taking pictures a few days before, right on, and a few days after those equinoxes. And it is stunning how accurate it really is. My question is, who are we, really? I mean, how long have we been here? How long has the human race been here? And, you know, we're not knuckle-dragging Neanderthals. We're not Cro-Magnons floating around with the honeybees following the crop and chasing herds with wooden sticks. We're not making fire by rubbing two sticks together or slapping two stones together and blowing on a leaf and wearing animal skins. These are intelligent, mathematically adept astronomers who have built amazing stargazing, lunar gazing, and solar gazing equipment. Why? Did they do it for a hobby? Did some lone scientist misplaced out of time go out there in the middle of Brooks, Alberta, Canada, and set up stones over a mile in diameter to measure the sun? I doubt it. I think it was important for them to know where the sun was and how it was moving. If the sun moved or something was late, it wasn't just when to plant and when to harvest. They knew if something went out of kilter, a cataclysm was coming. Now, the Maya appeared to spend most of their wealth in technology and manpower on leaving a message for us, not for them. They didn't do it for them. They left it for us. Now, did their desires leave a legacy that awakens us, or does it just make it curious? Do we just get on a tour bus and go down there and say, how interesting that was, let's go out to eat tonight? Or do we realize that these designs weren't trial and error? They were done right the first time, and they were done right so that we would see that they had this forethought, and they weren't looking for the end of their year. They were looking for our day. And I'm sure individually, well, no, wait, I was going to make a declarative statement there. I was going to say that they didn't think that they would live until now. They weren't building it for themselves, thinking that they would be alive in the 21st century to see these things line up the way they had predicted. But maybe they did believe that. Maybe they did know that they would be alive at this time, and that it would remind them who they were and where they came from. You know, the race that built the pyramids certainly at least had a fascination with the Sirian star system. The ancient peoples of North America measured the stars and the moon with astonishing accuracy, as you can tell by Gordon Friedman's study. Why? What were they waiting for? Or were they waiting for someone? Did they want to be ready when a certain date arrived? Well, if they packed for a departure, they did an amazing job because they left no one and nothing behind but their buildings. It has been said that if we left today, just got on a ship and left Earth, those of us that know how to do stuff, our legacy would return to dust within 10,000 years. Barely a blink of the cosmic eye, I would say. So we would drift into ignominy as quickly as they did. Fortunately, some of the things that they built were out of solid granite. It takes the winds of time and the ebb of seas and the quake of earth a long time to take something built to take the beating to fall to the ground. It didn't. It stayed. It lasted. And maybe, just maybe, those structures are igniting, awakening, turning on, really blazing some message inside of us, like in the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the character played by Richard Dreyfuss, driven nearly insane by his visions of the Devil's Tower, making them out of everything from mashed potatoes to a garden shrubbery, and finally he made the connection and followed the invitation. Are you being driven the same way? Are you having the same visions? That's a question worth asking yourself. As we explore this planet, we learn a little bit about where we came from, why we're here. We learn a little bit about the concentration, or at least the focal point of ancient peoples. And you wonder, just look at it from a project management standpoint. You don't even have to look at it from an engineer's standpoint. You don't even have to look at it from a scientist's standpoint. You're a project engineer, and you're going to the leaders of the state who are trying to keep social, political, and economic control of their particular society. And you come up with an idea. You want to build a building. And I'm sorry to say, but it's going to take longer than your lifetime to build it. How do you get a leader involved in that? Oh, and by the way, it's not really to your legacy. We're leaving a message for people that are going to be born 1,500 years from now that the planet is going to be lined up with this galactic plane in the galaxy, and it's really important because they might be bombarded with these dark particles in space, and they might have to take some precautions. So we need to build something that's sort of like a giant granite cartoon because we can't leave it in a language. Our language won't be preserved for that long. They're not going to be able to understand what we mean. So we have to leave it in some kind of structure that they will understand, that will wake them up, that will make them as a people, a population, a race, realize that they've got to get their act together or they're going to go extinct. Or that is to say, we're going to go extinct. Because we're born again and again and again, and I, as an engineer, for one, I'm going to be alive in that day, and I want to survive. I want to make it off this planet, or I want to go with the planet wherever it goes. But we got to be ready. We can't just go through life doing the same things we were doing, living from paycheck to paycheck, family vacation to family vacation. We can't save up some stupid 401k and buy all the toys thinking it's going to make us happy. That's not the purpose of life at all. We got to let them know. And so they build these amazing edifices to let us know. But unfortunately, they are inherited by short-minded men who are willing to dig in the dark of night to discover secretly what lies or lay beneath the earth and spirit it away in wooden crates, where mankind will never know. I hate to sound like Indiana Jones, but I, for one, believe it belongs in a museum. We need to see it. We need to know what came out of there, because it might be something for us. It might be a message. In fact, it might be a message left by you, or you, or even you. And maybe you need that message. Maybe you left it behind for yourself. That's my reasoning. That's my take on it. And this is X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We will see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. And hey, don't enjoy the summer too much out there. You know, there's a lot of solar radiation going out there. And if you're staying out there to the point where your skin turns red, it's not a good thing. It'll catch up with you eventually. Race week coming up. Here in the eastern part of the country, Charlotte Motor Speedway tomorrow starts all the qualification races. You'll be able to see it on television. Don't forget that you could pick up the ebook of Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. You could pick up the ebook by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Buy the ebook. It's less than $8. You can read that. You get all the photographs in color, all the drawings and illustrations in color. And then when the printed version comes out in less than 40 days now, you'll get 25% off of that. You can have it on your library shelf and already have the knowledge in your head. We're running out of time here, so I'm trying to get it in your hands. Also, I'll be presenting at the eSETI conference. This is July 4th weekend, Trout Lake, Washington. Go sign up for it. If you're within a day's drive, you have no excuse. If you haven't seen a UFO, here's the place. Go to Trout Lake, Washington. You can get there. Go to eSETI, ECETI.org, and register. By the way, those of you from the Questers up there in Calgary, Canada, where we had our meeting, thank you so much for your wonderful hospitality, for your great spirits of exploration. And if you're listening to this as an archive, I want you to feel my heartfelt gratitude. I was treated with great dignity and respect, and I appreciate it. Your hospitality was unmatched. And to Olds College, what a great facility up there in Olds, Alberta. Just a wonderful facility, an agricultural college, well-built, great hospitality, great food, wonderful stargazing. Bless you all with long life. Continue to search for the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.